Oh, it's Iowa.
Oh, and this is Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the show. Greg Kokel, your host, for the next 2 hours of careful thinking about the most important issues of life. That would be ethics, values, and religion. Kind of the holy trinity of important things. And if you'd like to call me and talk with me about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion, you can do so. Here's the number, 1-800-227-5278. And if you're in the 714 area code here in Southern California, just dial direct 754-4150. As I said, I'm Greg Kokel, your host here every Sunday, 3 to 5, to give you a piece of my mind. And lately, it seems like more and more people are wanting that, which is fine. I'm glad to give it. I like talking and giving advice. Sometimes I give too much when it's not asked for, but just recently it was asked for by my niece, and I'm going to write someday. I'm going to write a book entitled "Hey Uncle Greg," because that's the way the emails always start from my niece Kirsten, who is now in where do they have that big disaster? New Orleans. She's been there for a few years now, picking up the pieces, and so my hat's off to her on that. A follower of Christ all her life, but she seems to get herself into these circumstances where she's hanging out with people who don't have the same kind of convictions that she has, which, by the way, is great, but then engages them in spiritual conversation and gets herself backed into a corner, and then she hits the email button, and there's a "Hey, Uncle Greg" on the way. And I just got one of these a couple of days ago. So I thought I'd share with you something that she asked in this conversation with her friend Pete, because I think it has relevance to us on an ongoing basis, not just the details of the issue itself, but there's a broader kind of lesson, I think, to be learned from this. And let me just read you at least the first email she sent out. There was actually three in the series. And I don't have all my responses to everything, but I spent basically the whole afternoon of my day off just banging away. And sometimes when I get an email like this, I know I'm supposed to be doing other things like fixing the stair or, you know, changing the light bulbs or something like that. But the challenge that she faces gets under my skin just enough to say, you know what? She shouldn't have to settle for that. Hold on a minute. I'm going to knock out a response. And then 3 hours later, I got a chapter to a book, you know, and that's really the point. I'm saving all of this stuff, and maybe someday, if you see the title, "Hey, Uncle Greg," you'll know what it's about. Here was the email. "I have a quick question for you." And, of course, the questions are always quick. It's the answers that take a while, right? "I've been trying to find it in the Bible where Jesus addresses homosexuality, and I can't find it anywhere. Does this mean Jesus never addressed the subject?" Now, of course, I'm not surprised at this question because this is an issue raised lots of times by those who do not share, you know, the average evangelical Christian's view of homosexuality. For those who think that homosexuality is benign, they are often quick to point out that Jesus never condemned it, and so that's part of what's going on here. And notice, by the way, how people are very quick to try to get Jesus on their team. I mean, it's just something to keep in the back of your mind. Why do people care what Jesus has to say? It's because Jesus has credibility, right? So you just keep that in mind, because that's a fact that you can use in other conversations. And it's a point that I make all the time, because when you start, instead of quoting the Bible says... You quote Jesus instead. It's the same thing, but it's different because it's received differently. People can gainsay a book, especially a religious one, but when you start citing Jesus' own teaching, well, Jesus has credibility. He's a lot harder to deal with. In any event, that's just a side issue. She goes on to say, I have a friend that I go to an Episcopal church with here in New Orleans, and he thinks we shouldn't judge homosexuals because Jesus didn't. Okay. By the way, Jesus did judge a whole lot of people. Anybody who says Jesus wasn't judgmental has not read Jesus. He was among the most judgmental people, but he was judgmental in the appropriate way. Continuing, and he says, I can't take the Bible literally because in the Old Testament it says homosexuals should be put to death, and that obviously goes against Jesus' message to love sinners. I'm just trying to figure out how to dialogue with him on this issue, which is wonderful. I'm glad that she wrote. Now, another aside, and I kind of explained this in the final letter, which I don't have a copy of here, that I sent back to her, but I just want to go very quickly to this taking the Bible literally issue. Do not ever respond to the question, do you take the Bible literally, with the answer yes. The question, do you take the Bible literally, is a sucker punch. You cannot walk away from that challenge responding that way without suffering injury, all right? Now, I don't mean to say that the people who ask the question are asking it with ill will. It is one of those sloganistic challenges to followers of Christ or evangelical Christians that Christians think they have, that they are giving the right, faithful, evangelical, Bible is the inspired word of God kind of answer when they say, yes, I take it literally. This is wildly confusing. Don't ever say yes to that question. A better way, and I've just written this recently, I think we sent it out in a mentoring letter a couple of months ago, last month or something, and if you get it, you can go back to that. Maybe the one that was just came out. I think I got it in the mail last week. So that would make it the, what is this, April? This is the April mentoring letter. If you don't get that, go to str.org. Sign up. It's free. You get solid ground, alternating months, and bi-monthly the mentoring letter, the opposite months. In any event, don't say, yes, I take the Bible literally. You say, yes, I take, what you say is, I take the Bible at face value. I take the Bible at face value. I mean, if somebody says, do you take this sports page literally? They're going to say, well, it kind of depends what I'm reading. If I'm reading the scores, yes. But when it says that, you know, the Giants trounced the Braves, does that work? Are they both the same? They're both baseball, right? Giants and Braves. In any event, pick any teams you want. Fill in the blanks. They trounced them. They ate them up. They destroyed them. They dismembered them. Well, obviously, you're not taking that literally. You're taking it at face value. You realize that these are figures of speech meant to communicate a literal truth, captured, by the way, in the score. And so this is commentary. So you read the Bible the same way you read the sports page, by and large. The reason people got caught up in the literal thing is what they really mean is you don't believe the weird stuff. Like Adam and Eve and Jonah and the big fish and Sodom and Gomorrah. And what are the other big ones, like the weird ones? Things like that. The flood. Well, my answer is yes, I do believe in those things because Jesus did. Ironically, those four things are things that Jesus spoke directly to. Anyway, that's a separate issue. Here's what I wrote back. As far as I know, Jesus never addressed homosexuality per se. But two mistakes are often made regarding this observation. First, Jesus must have therefore been supportive of homosexuality. And by the way, that is implicit in the challenge, isn't it? Lay off of us because Jesus didn't beat us up, so you can't either. And since he was either supportive of homosexuality or at least thought it was morally benign, you should adopt his view because after all, you're followers of him, aren't you? The second mistake that's often made is they think that nothing else Jesus said could have given us any indirect evidence of his opinions of this. And both of those are false. That is, just because Jesus didn't speak on it directly doesn't mean he's benign regarding it. And secondly, that it's false that Jesus didn't say something else that might weigh in on behalf of the homosexual question. He did. And then I offer a tactical move here. Before I get to the specifics, I tell her if I were talking to your friend on these issues, I'd ask some questions. Of course, you know, that's the Columbo tactic. I'd ask questions before I offered my own explanation because I think this person has some questions to answer too in light of this particular challenge. You can use them, these questions, to promote dialogue with your friend. That's what you wanted. You mentioned that in the letter. And the point would be to show that these kinds of challenges are often poorly thought out and that nothing meaningful can be concluded from the observations your friend has made. The questions serve that purpose while making them, the challengers, do the heavy lifting and not you. And of course, you know, if you've at all exposed to the Columbo tactic, you know this is part of the purpose of it. It's to realize that they got a lot of splaining to do themselves, right? And they can't just get away with making the challenges and it just everything goes away for them. They're on the high road. They don't have any work to do. You do all the heavy lifting nonsense. So I say, if I were you, I'd ask each of these questions one by one and listen to for a substantive response before I'd go ahead with the direct answer to the challenges that you've offered. And this will force your friend, I said, to think about the challenges that he has offered. So, here are my questions regarding the issue of the death penalty for homosexuals. How does the death penalty for homosexuals in the Old Testament, and by the way, it was there in Leviticus, how does the fact that you find this in the Old Testament mean that we shouldn't take the Bible literally? I mean, the Jews and the theocracy thought it was pretty clear. That's why they executed homosexuals. They took it literally. Now, there may be a legitimate question of how this applies in our own time for Gentiles outside of the theocratic system of Judaism, which I'm going to address in just a moment. I mean, that may be a legitimate question. But I don't see how this has anything to do with whether or not the statements in the law, Leviticus 18 and 20, were meant to be taken literally. I mean, this was part of Israel's legal code, wasn't it? Legal codes are not written in figurative language. They are always meant to be literal. That's the way laws work. And in fact, people who are careful about passing laws take as much ambiguity out of them as possible. So the first thing seems to me that this person's comments about literal are completely misplaced. Whether the is are laws to be meant to be taken literally? Of course they are. Now, it's a different question whether that law taken literally by Jews at that time is meant for us to be practiced at this time in the same way as it was then. That's a different question. But just because we don't practice that law today as they did then, it doesn't mean that that law wasn't literal. And my second question, if it's not to be taken literally, how do we take it? Figuratively? And what figurative meaning could such a text possibly have? Any man who lies with another man, as he lies with a woman, this is an abomination. They should both be put to death. This isn't poetry. There's no metaphors there. There's no similes. There's no figures of speech. So how do we take it if we don't take it literally? That's another question. Can you give me a paraphrase of those verses taken in a non-literal sense that would make any sense of the passage itself? Three, if we are not to take the Bible literally, as this person is arguing in light of the statements in Leviticus about homosexuality, then why does the challenger take Jesus' statements literally? We got to love sinners, right? Gee, I wonder what Jesus could mean. Obviously, we don't take that literally. It's a mystery then. We'll have to work on that. The injunction to love your enemies seems, on first blush, completely counterintuitive and ridiculous. Listen, if I were to take anything non-literally, it would be Jesus' idea to love your enemies. Why? I mean, doesn't that, I mean, when you're used to hearing that Jesus said that, but if just pretend you never heard it, and somebody comes up and he says, oh, love your enemies. You think, are you kidding? What could be more counterintuitive than that? So why not just simply dismiss that kind of thing, that odd notion, as not to be taken literally? That makes more sense to me. But he wants to dismiss the injunctions against homosexuality as not literal, but he's quite ready to take Jesus' admonition to love your enemy and love sinners and forgive people 70 times 7 and all those kinds of things. Quite literally. That seems to be odd. And I would like to hear his answer for that inconsistency. Now, regarding Jesus' own view of homosexuality, I have some further questions for that person. So there are two challenges that were offered to me. And before I even get to the answer of the challenge, I have a series of questions regarding the way the challenges, each of them was offered. Here's the second challenge. If Jesus never condemned homosexuality, let's just say we can't find a single verse in which Jesus condemned homosexuality. If Jesus never condemned homosexuality, so what? I mean, what would that prove? Is it right to conclude from Jesus' silence that he was pro-gay? I mean, if that's a right way of reasoning, then Jesus was pro-gay bashing too, because he never said anything about gay bashing. He was pro-child molesting. He was pro-wife beating. He was pro-slavery, because he never enjoined any of those as being morally questionable. Now, I hope this goes to show that this is not a productive way of reasoning. And so anybody who offers an objection on this basis, the objection simply fails. Now, this doesn't mean that Jesus was against homosexuality. It doesn't mean that he's for homosexuality. It means you cannot come to any conclusion based on his silence. You might ask your friend, if Jesus had condemned homosexuality, would that change your mind on this issue? I think not for most. And by the way, if not, then why raise the issue of Jesus' attitude at all? If it doesn't seem to ultimately matter, you want Jesus on your side when he's on your side. And then if he's not on your side, then you just disavow it. Like, well, that's just in the Bible. That's just written by men. Doesn't matter. As it turns out, Jesus did say a number of things that make it clear he was not pro-gay. First, Jesus thought he was God. It's a separate issue to demonstrate this, but this is very clear from the text. The same God, by the way, who gave the Old Testament scriptures. Now, it doesn't matter if any detractor believes Jesus was God or not. That doesn't matter to our point here. It only matters for our point that Jesus did. Now, if Jesus thought he was God, the same God as the Old Testament, then and as my niece's friend pointed out, the Old Testament condemns homosexuality, then guess what? Jesus condemned homosexuality. He was responsible for those laws. Second, Jesus said the entire law was valid, and he said it with force in Matthew chapter 5. This would include the passages in Leviticus that condemn homosexuality as an abomination. Therefore, Jesus agrees with the Old Testament condemnation of homosexuality. Third, in other words, I'm giving you three reasons to show that you can properly infer from the account of Jesus what he actually believed about homosexuality, even though he didn't speak of it explicitly. Third, Jesus made very specific comments on what God intended for marriage in Matthew chapter 19 that has a direct bearing on this issue. He said that God created only two sexes and each was made for the other sexually. And that's why you find that one flesh phrase in there. This leaves no room in Jesus' own theology for affirming same-sex sexual relationships. It's just not there. So it's a mistake to assume that Jesus must be in favor of anything he doesn't explicitly condemn, first. Secondly, Jesus was an observant Jew who endorsed the entire law for the purpose for which it was intended, that is, governing Jews under the theocracy. There was also no hint that the same regulations, execution for homosexuals, should apply outside of that system, by the way, though it ought to give us a sense of what God himself thinks of this activity. And, of course, this was reinforced when Jesus explicitly endorsed the normative sexual relationship that exists between men and women only as God's design for creation, or I should say as God's only design for creation. So, I mean, for the sake of discussion, we could be wrong in the homosexuality question, but those who disagree on that are not going to get any aid and comfort from Jesus of Nazareth. All right, 1-800-227-5278 is our number. If you're in the 714 area code, dial up 754-4150. Some people already on the line. We've got another couple hours, really, pretty much, to talk with you in a clear-headed fashion. Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Stay with us. Hi, this is Greg Kokel, letting you know that Stand to Reason is back with an unmatched cruise conference experience featuring some of the top Christian thinkers in the country. On August 2nd, 2008, we'll set sail from Vancouver, BC for 8 days aboard one of Holland America's finest cruise ships. We're planning a voyage you'll never forget. It's specifically designed for those who want to represent Christ to a world looking for answers to life's toughest questions. Here's our plan. We want to challenge you with thoughtful presentations, answer your questions in open forum discussions, and enrich you through interaction and fellowship with expert speakers and fellow passengers. Add to that the stunning splendor of the Alaskan coastline and a 7-day itinerary that includes Glacier Bay, Skagway, Juneau, and Ketchikan. I'll be joined by some of our distinguished guest speakers, Josh McDowell, J.P. Moreland, and Sean McDowell. Come and join Stand to Reason and our lineup of speakers for a memorable spiritual adventure. You'll enjoy plenty of fun and relaxation, along with ample opportunity to meet our speakers, ask questions, and enjoy each other's company. Listen, if studying Christian subjects with some of the sharpest minds on the planet, in the fellowship of other believers of kindred spirit, aboard a beautiful ship sailing the Alaskan coastline, sounds like your idea of a perfect vacation, then this is the trip for you. As always, you don't need any prior understanding of the subject matter. Simply bring a desire to learn in a relaxing environment. We planned everything about this trip with your enjoyment and your enrichment in mind. But don't just take my word for it. Visit STR.org and see what other guests of Stand to Reason have said about past STR cruises. Save the dates, download the brochure from STR.org, and then contact Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. They're helping us with our trip, and their skilled staff are committed to answering all your questions. I look forward to seeing you on board. This takes me back to college. Greg Kokel is Stand to Reason. Incidentally, I saw one of their, this is Simon and Garfunkel, one of their albums, actually Starbucks. So they're kind of, they're cool, right? Even though they're cool old guys there at Starbucks. Let's see. Might as well go quickly to the phones here. Taking your calls here, 1-800-227-5278. And can I, Melinda, can I say something about, Melinda, turn around and look through that window there. Hello? I guess she's not, she can't hear me right. Can I say something about what we just did? Okay, maybe not. I'll have to ask her. Let's go to the phones and talk with Catherine. Catherine, Los Angeles, welcome to Stand to Reason. Hi.
Oh, hello. Thank you, Greg. Can you hear me?
Sure.
I want to say first, it's an honor to speak with you, and
I thank you
and your staff for offering such well-organized and compelling arguments. I totally appreciate your controlled indignation.
My opening comments?
In general, I've been listening for the last 2 years of podcasts. I just discovered you, so I've been listening to you, and you never lose your temper. You are always courteous ardor on these hot topics.
Thank you. Well, that might be true in the podcast you listen to. Generally, I think that's true, and I've kind of learned better, but I have lost it in the past. And the real goal here, and just to be completely honest with everybody, is to maintain the same equanimity in all areas of my life and not just in my public broadcasting.
Totally understand.
So, although it's easier to be good when you got thousands of people listening to mm-hmm. you know, and you're supposed to be the coach, right?
So, I got it.
Anyway, I'm not perfect on that. I'm still working on that in other areas of my life. But thank you for the comments, Catherine.
Thank you. I am, like you, I'm coming out of a Catholic tradition. I had 12 years of Catholic school, and we never once cracked the Bible. I'm still trying to forgive them for that. So I'm trying to align my thinking now with Scripture, and here's my question. I understand about we must make a decision for Christ. I get that. The only way to the Father through Jesus. I've got your booklet about 100 ways. It's always Jesus. But
100 verses that indicate that Jesus is the only way of salvation.
Exactly.
Correct, yeah. Which I wrote, by the way, specifically because of pushback I've gotten from Roman Catholic priests on this issue.
Oh, yeah. I've heard, and I know some of the priests you've talked about. I know them. Yeah.
They're good people, but it's just, anyway, yeah, go ahead.
Right. So my question is, you know, I've been referred to some scriptures in Hebrews and Corinthians about, you know, we have a judgment to face after death, but it doesn't say that we can't make a decision after we die.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand, especially in this business about, you know, we enter an eternal now. Couldn't there be a moment, it's one moment evidently after we die and it continues, but couldn't there be a moment after we die, particularly in light of these near-death experiences we hear about people that meet people? Wouldn't there be a possibility that we could choose for Christ after we die?
I don't think there is any possibility of this at all, and I'll tell you a couple of reasons. First of all, I can think just off the top of my head of two biblical passages that seem to forcibly argue against the possibility. Okay, I'll tell you those in just a moment.
Yes, please.
But I want to give you this. I want to sketch out my argument first. First, I think the Bible verses speak against this. Secondly, there is no verse that speaks in favor of it. Thirdly, it has to do with maybe what you would call a Pascal's wager, cost-benefit analysis, all right? Let's just say I'm wrong And a person who promotes the idea that you can make a decision after you die is right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If I preach that you can't, you have to make a decision before you die, and I think this is what the Bible teaches.
Mm-hmm.
If I offer that, and it turns out that I am wrong, and some people can make a decision after and do,
mm-hmm.
what bad fallout is there from that error?
Mm-hmm.
Zero. There's more people in heaven than I thought there was, right?
Right.
But if... If the other view, people are saying, well, you can make a decision afterwards. If they teach that and that's wrong, what is lost if they're mistaken? And the answer is you've encouraged people in this life to be cavalier about addressing the issue that is most important for eternity, thinking that, well, if I don't deal with it now, I can kind of deal with it afterwards. And then there is no opportunity afterwards once they die. They're sealed in their decision, their rejection of the offer of pardon and forgiveness that God has offered. And there is no hope for them. Oh, I just thought of another verse. I just thought of a third one. So I'm going to give you those verses in just a minute.
Okay.
From that perspective, there's nothing to gain by thinking you might have another chance after death, and much to lose, where in my perspective there's nothing to lose and potentially much to gain.
Oh, pardon me. I do agree with you about this. I'm thinking particularly, in fact, of the homosexual community that in my age range they were brutalized by Christians as children. And,
uh-huh.
You know, they have emotional reactions. They haven't thought through it. I'm thinking of people who have an emotional block. It's imprudent to delay this decision. I'm
right.
with you. But perhaps they're not able to get to it.
Well, from God's perspective, they are able because he is going to hold them responsible.
Mm.
I don't know why, by the way, dying and kind of being in some kind of a halfway house in the netherworld solves that problem anyway. So let's say they're emotionally brutalized by Christians when they're young, and so they have a psychological block against it, and then they die and they're standing in the netherworld waiting.
Mm.
Does the block just go away? Does the emotional barriers fall just because now they're in the netherworld?
Oh, I do think it's possible. I followed some of Lewis's thinking that some of this stuff that are accidentals of our situation on earth will simply fall off us when we die, and then we will make true decisions about who we really are.
Well, no, I think that's absolutely the case. But that's because, that's for other reasons. But I'm trying to take it from the perspective of the other person. You know, why would they, you know, are they, you know, I guess they could say, well, that's because I'll see everything clearly as it really is. Look at when we die, we are instantly transformed. Then we will know fully as we have been fully known.
Right.
All right.
Right.
If you follow Lewis, by the way, in the last battle, you remember the dwarves?
Yes.
The dwarves are for the dwarves, right? And even when they're in the other world and everything's beautiful,
they keep eating dirt.
They keep eating dirt.
Right.
It seems like dirt to them.
Right.
So, you know, even on Lewis's view, you know, it's still I don't think you can help there. But this isn't really the real issue. I mean, I think all three of those legs of my argument are powerful. One, there seems to be verses clearly against it. And I'll give you three in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Two, I just forgot one of the verses, but maybe it'll come back. Two, there is no evidence for it.
Mm-hmm.
And three, there is, taking the conservative view, there is nothing to lose and much to gain.
Mm.
Taking the liberal view, there is much to lose and nothing to gain.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
So if you're just based on a prudential consideration, you should argue that you have to make your decisions on this side. By the way, do you get a sense when you are reading, say, the book of Acts where the gospel goes forth, is there a sense of urgency communicated by the apostles regarding this decision? Or do they have kind of a lackadaisical attitude?
Oh, no.
Figuring,
no,
you know, you can cover it now or later, whatever.
No, that's not the case. In fact, they got beaten up and mauled for their...
So, yes, exactly.
Right.
So I'm starting to build my case that the Bible actually explicitly and implicitly teaches such a thing.
Mm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wait, Lazarus. Just a minute. And Hebrews. Okay. I'm making my note here so I don't forget these verses. Oh. So here's my line of argument for the first point that I made, that the scriptures actually teach against this. First of all, implicitly, because you can see this intensity as the gospel goes out. Man, it seems to matter.
Yes.
Don't wait. It may be too late. I mean, this is, seems to be an urgency there. Now, why might there be an urgency? Hebrews chapter 9, verse 27.
Right.
It's appointed for men to die once, and after this comes the judgment.
Right.
Now, yeah, you know, you could say, yeah, but how far after this comes the judgment? And it doesn't specify it in between. And my response is, no, it doesn't. And so that's why we should just take it at its face value. We should just simply say, you die once and then the judgment. And it seems to suggest a finality there.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have Jesus and the rich man and Lazarus.
Yes.
He gives the account of the rich man who's in the grave and Lazarus who's died and is the bosom of Abraham. And there's no indication like there's like a halfway house they can make the decision. No, this is resolved. Judgment is still off in the future, but the fate of the rich man has been resolved. There's no changing it. He's not going to get just a bit of water to put on his lips to take his torment away that he's experiencing.
Mm.
I have no reason to believe, by the way, that this is a parable. But even if it were a parable, that this is a figurative language, what is the literal truth the parable is meant to teach? It certainly doesn't follow that it's meant to teach that there's a second chance after death, because there's nothing suggested even in the parable that that's the case, but rather that there's a finality about this decision and you can't go back and change things.
Yes,
okay, now I'm going to give you the last verse that came to me just when I said about no hope, and then a verse came to mind.
Mm.
And that is in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, a passage dear to many pre-tribbers.
Mm-hmm.
It says, verse 13, "But we do not want you to be uninformed, brethren, about those who are asleep." Now, this is a figurative way of speaking. What does he mean by asleep? Does he mean people who are sleeping?
Mm. No, dead.
No, they're dead.
Right.
Right. This is a figure of speech for death. "Now, we don't want you to be uninformed, brethren, about those who are asleep, dead, that you may not grieve." Why would people grieve about sleeping people? No, it's the sleeping people who don't wake up. It's a word based on the appearance. They look like they're asleep, but they're dead. They're gone, okay?
Mm-hmm. Right.
"That you may not grieve, as do the rest who have," what?
Oh, no hope.
No hope.
Mm.
Because, "For if we believe that Jesus has died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep
in
Jesus."
Mm.
When you die in Christ, you're safe. When you die without him, that's it. Then you stand on your own before a holy God and give an account for your life. That's Revelation chapter 20. The books are open, and every person in that group is judged according to their works. And we know that that's not a pretty picture, because when they are judged according to their works, every single person so judged fails the test, and each is cast into the lake of fire.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is the first time I thought of this verse with regards to this question that you've raised, but it seems to me this is univocal. That is, there's no way out of this one in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4.
Oh, I understand.
It makes it really clear. So there's a whole host of reasons that I've offered to you that should give no comfort to anyone who thinks there might be a second chance. And by the way, anybody who is teaching such a thing is in peril. And here's the reason why. Because they are giving false comfort to those who need to decide now. Today is the acceptable day. Today is the day of salvation. There is this sense of urgency given by that we find in the voice of the apostles as they preach this message, and the sense of urgency is based on a good reason.
Mm-hmm.
And the good reason is that there is no second chance after death. And if you say anyone says there is, they are manufacturing this out of thin air, contrary to what the scriptures seem to be teaching. And they are giving false hope to people who will of a certainty perish if they take that hope to the grave.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the hope that there's a second opportunity.
I see.
No way.
It lines up with that Hebrews 2, verse 3, how shall we escape if we ignore such a great salvation?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, someone could say with regard to that verse, well, I maybe ignored it in this life, but I won't ignore it in the next life. But there you hear, though, this sense of urgency,
yes.
I think. And I think that is because these other verses here teach us the truth that the apostles believed and Jesus did as well. This is the lifetime where these decisions are made, where the issues are resolved. And when you pass through the gates of death, that's the end of it. You know, the show is over there for that person.
Mm.
And thankfully, some people come to their senses on their deathbed.
Mm-hmm.
I think they suffer great loss in so doing because
oh, yeah.
they, in my opinion, mm-hmm. well, a number of things. In my opinion, I think they enter eternity spiritually, like spiritual babes.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that I have no good reason to believe that any significant spiritual growth happens afterwards. There may be growth of knowledge and relationship with God, but there's a sense in which I think we're fixed in our spiritual growth at death. And this is why we are enjoined to develop godliness in this life, because it holds a promise not just for this life, but also for the life to come, Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy. So,
which is really long.
Yeah, really, really long. Very good, Catherine. Thank you for your call, dear.
Thank you so much.
All right, good talking to you. And why don't we just jump to break here a little. Barb, can we go to break early? All right, and then we'll get to the rest of your calls after break. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason.
Human suffering poses the most difficult question anyone can ask about a God who is both good and powerful. Do you know how to respond to the presence of evil and suffering in the world? Are you struggling with this question personally and need some clear thinking on the issue? Are you doubting God's goodness or know someone that is? Let Greg help you think through this important question. Order the tape set, Three Tough Questions from Stand to Reason. You'll also get Greg's training on two other questions that many struggle with today, the heathen and the unknown God, and Is One Way the Only Way? You'll be equipped to answer three of the toughest questions leveled against Christianity by the time you've thoroughly gone through this material. Extensive notes are included for your study. Order today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or by visiting our website at www.str.org.
Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. Do you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians, just like you, to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. My favorite performers of all time, Simon and Garfunkel, incredible lyricist, tremendous harmony, great guitar work, and you can actually understand what they're saying. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason, and we have just started actually filming my opening commentaries. And that's what you wondered. I was trying to get Melinda's attention at the last segment, saying, hey, can I tell him about this? Well, yeah, I guess I just got permission. We can. We did it last week the first time just to see how it works, and we filmed this one. And so we are going to be posting these sometime in the future. I can't give you a specific date because it takes a little bit of production work, but we're going to be starting to post these on our website, not on our website, but on YouTube. Is that right? Or GodTube or something like that. And you'll get information about this. And is this a subscription item, Melinda? So people who are podcasting there's some way we're going to work it together so you can be notified when they're posted. And if you want to, you know, look at my talking head, you're welcome to do so. You'll get more information later. The enforcer's raising her eyes. Oh, she's had plenty of that. All right. back to the phones, and let's go to Seal Beach. Seal Beach and Tammy. Hi.
Hi. Hi, Greg.
How you doing?
I'm good. I'm in a ministry that reaches out to help Jehovah's Witnesses, and one of the, well, I actually got two people now in debate, and they've scripturally been able to handle all, most of all their, even though they disagree, you know, their questions, but they sent me this thing called Christian Neutrality in Pagan Rome. Supposedly it's a quote from Arnold Toynbee, and I can't find the book in my local library.
Okay, you said Christian Neutrality in Pagan Rome. Was that it?
That's it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And in this quote, it says, at as late as the date of 295 CE, Maximilius of whatever, son of a Roman army veteran, was conscripted for military service. When the proconsul asked him his name, he answered, how do you know, now why do you want to know my name? He says, I have a conscientious objection to military service.
Okay.
And he says, I'm a Christian. I can't serve. I can't sin against my conscience. Mm-hmm. The proconsul warned him that he would lose his life if he did not obey. He says, I won't serve.
Mm-hmm.
You may behead me, but I won't serve the powers of this world.
Mm-hmm.
I will serve my God. So do you have any comments about that or how I should respond to that?
Well, my response is probably, if I have reason to trust Toynbee and his primary source documentation, then we have an accurate account of a man who had a conscientious objection as a Christian to the war. I'm not sure what else we can conclude from that. Now, my suspicion is that Jehovah's Witnesses conclude that Christians should not be involved in war.
Correct.
But why would they take it based on Maximus's? Is that his name, Maximus?
Well, Arnold Toynbee is supposedly quoting from this.
Yes, Maximus was the Christian who had a So why should we take Maximus's point of view as doctrinally sound? All right, I served in the military. Yes, I was at one point. From 1970, hold on, Melinda tells me not to use dates because I sound senile. So in 1968 to 1974, I became a Christian in 1973. So from 1973 to 1974, I was a member of the U.S. Armed Forces. Greg Kokel, Christian. Now, maybe I can call Arnold Toynbee, and he can write my story down and say, Greg Kokel, member of the U.S. Armed Forces, was a Christian, and as a conscientious issue, he served his country in the military without any difficulties. Okay, would this be evidence, then, that all Christians should fight in the military because Greg Kokel felt his conscience told him to do so?
No.
No. So then why should it be evidence that no Christians should fight in the military because Maximus or Maximilian or whatever his name is, Christian in, you know, third century or fourth century, end of the third century of the common era. Why should that matter? So what? Now, it turns out that most of the Christians in the first three or four centuries were pacifists. All right? So what? What matters is what the Bible teaches about it and what moral thinking applies to the question of pacifism. Quoting Toynbee or some Christian in the third century is not a legitimate theological argument. Now, I think, from my understanding, most of the Christians in the first few centuries were pacifists, based on their understanding of Jesus' teaching to turn the other cheek.
Right. That's what they said in their
Okay, well, see, now that's different. So forget about the first century Christians, first through third. Just say the reason we are to be pacifists is because Jesus said we should turn the other cheek. Now the question then comes, does pacifism follow from such a thing? Okay. I mean, that's the real question.
Right.
By the way, in other words, Jesus says if somebody strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the left. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, was Jesus ever struck on the cheek?
Yes.
Did he turn the other cheek?
Yes, I believe he did.
No, he didn't.
Oh, he didn't?
The time that we know he was struck on the cheek is at his trial, and when he was struck, he said, if I have done wrong, bear witness of the wrong. If I did not do wrong, why did you strike me? In other words, Jesus didn't turn the other cheek. Then he asked for an accounting of the behavior. He challenged the person who struck him. Now, that's in the record. So,
okay, so he challenged it. That's not passive resentment.
Well, what I'm trying to show you here is that simply saying, looking at when Jesus said turn the other cheek, and this means all these other things, Christian pacifism, that you just benignly just turn and let they hit you again. Well, this couldn't have been what Jesus meant, because Jesus didn't even follow that counsel when he was struck. All right? Yeah. And so what does it mean to you know, what does that actually mean? Well, Jesus said if anybody strikes you on the right cheek, do you think more people are left-handed or right-handed?
Right-handed.
Okay, if a person is right-handed, how do you, you're facing somebody else, right? How do you strike them on the right cheek with your right hand?
Oh, with the back of the hand.
With the back of the hand. Exactly. Jesus is not talking about pacifism here. He's talking about returning evil for evil. Somebody who strikes you and insults you, that you do not take your personal revenge on that person. And by the way, there are a number of other verses who say that say the very same thing. He is not saying government shouldn't do its work in punishing evildoers. A lot of folks will use this verse to negate capital punishment. And so, no, in fact, the Bible teaches that the government is there for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. That's the government's job, to punish people. And sometimes the punishment is capital punishment. It does not bear the sword for nothing, is what Paul said. And he didn't, you know, he was not referring to, you know, he didn't use the sword for paddling, for goodness sake. So one other thought about this in the military, okay? We're in war right now, say, with Iraq. Okay, what was any of these soldiers that are over there fighting, were any of them struck in any way by an Iraqi, which caused them to respond in military action?
Well, our country was struck.
Well, our country was struck. That's part of it, yeah. But there was, I guess the point is, none of these military men were personally struck, right?
No, they're not out for personal revenge.
Pardon me?
They're not out for personal revenge against their
Of course, somebody else was struck.
Right.
Someone else was struck, and they are responding to keep the striker from striking again. So there is no parallel in warfare that we're currently in, or just warfare in general. There might be incidents of parallel in some actions of aggression that are inappropriate, but these people want to be pacifist in light of what Jesus said, and it doesn't follow from what Jesus said. None of it follows from what Jesus said.
Well, see, they're using that to discredit all Christianity, because, you know, we go to war, and then maybe we end up
Christians don't go to war, first of all. You know, but they're going to say your kind of Christianity is false because your kind of Christianity doesn't teach pacifism. And therefore, there can be Christians of your kind of Christianity that do go to war. And the answer is, well, yes, we don't teach pacifism. Pacifism is immoral. When we who are capable of stopping some big person from harming some little person do not do it, then we are guilty of an inaction that we ought to have done. In law, it's called nonfeasance. We are not doing what we ought to have done. If I am standing there watching a large man abuse a child, do I have any obligation to stop him?
Yes.
What if it requires that some kind of force in order for me to stop him? What if it's not enough for me to wave flowers at him and sing songs and about peace and love to him? That doesn't dissuade him. Do I have any obligation to step in? Now, some will say, yes, you can shield the baby, you know, but you can't strike him. Why can't I strike him? Why not? He's hurting the child.
Mm-hmm.
What if I can't shield him? Maybe that isn't going to work. He throws me out of the way. No, can I do? Can I? Am I morally allowed to use force against him, violent force? It seems to me this is obviously true, and nothing in what Jesus taught suggests otherwise. And in fact, if I don't act in whatever way I can to defend that innocent person, if I have the opportunity to do it and I don't do it, I've acted immorally. If I blithely stand by in my self-righteous pacifism while some child or some weak person or some person weaker than the one who's oppressing is doing that, and I do nothing when I could have done something, then I'm to blame. This is why I think pacifism is immoral, and it's a strict pacifism, and it's worse when it comes from the mouth of a Christian because they ought to know better. God is not a pacifist. The entire Old Testament is filled with God using warfare as an act of judgment by him to accomplish his purposes, and he initiates it.
Mm-hmm.
And there is nothing in the New Testament to teach otherwise. That the many of the New Testament Christians after the first few centuries disagreed with me is irrelevant. It's an interesting historical observation, but that they disagreed is not an argument that should matter. What should matter is what the text says. I think they misunderstood the text for the reasons I'm giving you.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody doesn't like that, it doesn't do any good to say, yeah, but there are a lot more of them than they were of you. We're not counting noses here, you know? We're looking at what the text says, and this text doesn't give any, I think, any legitimate reason for Christians to be pacifists in the sense that we're discussing it. By the way, a lot of Christians did not react and respond when they were being persecuted because they thought it a glory to die for Christ, and they were willing to die. They wanted to die for Christ. This is true of a number of the Christian leaders. They expected to die for Christ. They wanted to die for Christ. Now, it wasn't an act of suicide, but they were not looking for opportunities to oppose. You know, they weren't going to run away from persecution. They weren't going to hide. They were going to say, here I am, persecute me. I'm doing this for my Lord Jesus.
Right. Well, scripturally, I can't find one thing that supports saying that Christians can't be a part of military.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Now, with regards to your talks with Jehovah's Witnesses, I wouldn't spend a lot of time on this issue with them because, I mean, if they want to talk about it and you want to talk about it, fine. But you've told me you've addressed some of the other issues. I think these are tertiary issues. These are not primary. They're not secondary. They're like, it's like Christmas trees and birthdays and military activity and all that stuff. Yeah. This is irrelevant. I'll give them that. They can have their pacifism if they want. What matters to me is justification. Well, how do we get forgiven by God? And it isn't from knocking on doors or being a member of an organization like the Watchtower. Secondly, who is Jesus? And he's not a created being. Yeah, we have on our website a piece that I wrote called The Deity of Christ, Case Closed. I don't know if you've seen that.
Oh, I'll go look for it for sure.
Yeah, because I make there is an airtight argument for the deity of Christ from Scripture that you can use even from their own Bibles because this is a verse they haven't yet distorted in the New World Translation. And that's John chapter 1, verse 3.
I use that all the time.
Good.
Yeah.
All things came into being through him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. I actually use a little kind of a napkin demonstration so you can draw some squares, and I teach you how to. Is that the thing you use with them?
I have them make a column on a piece of paper, write
yes.
all things, you know, things that have
right,
already
right, right.
existed, things that were created.
Right.
That's
it. That's the argument.
And yeah, to me, that's airtight, too.
It is. Now, there's a couple little moves that they make to try to get out from it. In the article, I talk about those moves and how to respond to them, but because they're very weak moves, and they don't do the job of defeating this biblical, scriptural argument about Jesus being the uncreated creator. And guess what? If you're the uncreated creator, you're God, you're the guy, unless there's two of those guys up there that are uncreated, and the universe isn't big enough for two uncreated gods, you know.
Is one of those verses that they use, is it John 1:18, no one has seen God?
That's right. Well,
how do you respond to that?
Well, they don't see God. Jesus is a man who is also God. His divine essence is unseen. His physical human body is seen. He is man and God. You see the man, you don't see the God. Just like you don't see a person's soul when you look at them, but you know that body is ensouled. It's not just a bunch of meat sitting there. You're a human soul. united with a human body, a physical body. You see the physical body. The body isn't the soul. And on my view, at least, Jesus' body is a human body. It isn't God. But Jesus is God. And by the way, there's a tape at Stand to Reason that has notes with it that goes through a whole bunch of, I think, very powerful arguments on this issue you can think about. It's called The Trinity, A Solution, Not a Problem. The Trinity, A Solution, Not a Problem. So pick that up at str.org, and that'll help you too. Thanks for the call, and that's good for number one, hour number one. And hour number two just ahead. Look forward to talking with you here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us. Friends, Greg Kokel, one of the good guys, equipping you to think every weekend, Sundays 3 to 5 here on Stand to Reason. This is the show that's not for everyone. Sometimes it hurts to have to think. And we try to apply our best thinking to the most important issues. Ethics, values, and religion. And I am unashamed follower of Jesus of Nazareth, and we talk about that, of course, here on the show a lot. Defend that notion, clarify what it means. Take your calls, 1-800-227-5278, and in the 714 area code 754-4150. Just a reminder, we have a cruise coming up on August 2nd through 9th. This month is the last month pretty much to sign up with any guarantee that you're going to be able to get a room, because at the end of this month, the end of April, they start snatching all those rooms we have reserved away. So our numbers are growing as and people are kind of getting on board the last minute here, because they've been thinking about it for a while, and now they've decided, oh, I better strike the iron while it's still relatively warm. We'll be setting sail from Vancouver, BC, that's just north of Seattle there on Holland America's MS Staten Dam. Will be there for a full week, Sunday to Sunday, I think, is the way it works. And we are going to be obviously going to Glacier Bay. We're going to be in Skagway, Juneau, Ketchikan. Our guest speakers, Josh McDowell, Sean McDowell, J.P. Moreland, yours truly. So it's a fantastic combination of a wonderful vacation up the Inward Passageway at these great, great towns and locations in Alaska on a beautiful cruise ship where everything's provided. I mean, we've done this a number of times before, and it's an absolutely sensational getaway. But you can do it with people of kindred spirits, and you can learn a lot, too, from some of the best thinkers in the country in the area of making sense of historic Christianity and classical Christian values. So we hope you would consider joining us. And if you've been thinking about it, you've got about, let's see, today's the 13th. We've got about 2 weeks to go. So now's the time to move. And we got to talk about my mother-in-law and my sister-in-law. They're going to come. So they've already said yes. I'm talking to Melinda now. So you and I got to get that squared away. I didn't want to forget it because we got a deadline too, right? So I better practice what I'm preaching here. But go to str.org, and right there on our website, there's a link to all the information about our cruise, Anchoring Your Hope, August 2nd through 9th to Alaska. Let's go back to the phones here. And in Chi-Town, Chicago, you know, Mike, we've been getting a number of calls from Chicago. You guys waking up to Stand to Reason or something?
You know, I'm not sure. I don't even listen to it on the radio. I listen to it on the podcast. So
we don't have a footprint there. A live footprint, and everybody in Chicago is listening on podcasts. But I think we had two or more calls in the last couple of weeks. So I'm glad to hear from you guys. Did you know I grew up there in Chicago?
Yeah. I've talked to you before. I think you went to Northern Illinois, right?
I did. Yes, I did. Back in 1969 and 70, and I went to York High School. Graduate 68, we got our I think, our 40-year anniversary coming up. Ooh, boy, that's painful to think about. What's on your mind today, Mike?
Well, first I just wanted to tell you how much your ministry has really helped me out, you know, in the last year or so. Mm-hmm. A lot of your resources.
Well, I'm glad to help out.
You know, the Columbo tactic and a lot of that stuff. And actually, one of the first callers, I had to write this down. Controlled indignation, and that was something, you know, that's a great way of putting it, because, you know, I try to have that quality myself, but mm-hmm. you shouldn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, my question was had to deal with Genesis chapter 30, and you know, I was reading it a few weeks ago. I actually bought the Apologetic Study Bible. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I am familiar with it. I think Sean McDowell, who we're going to have on just a little bit, I think, with Brett Kunkel coming up next segment, I think, he was one of the contributors to that, if I'm not mistaken, and I'm sure his dad was as well, but I've heard good things about it.
Yeah, well, there's I've never found an answer to this question about Genesis chapter 30, and mm-hmm. now it almost seems like God is endorsing polygamy, in a sense. If I can maybe read a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know.
What's your verse?
The backline or the background. It just kind of seems like it's kind of the whole chapter. It's not one particular verse I'm looking
okay,
at.
Okay, I can't read the whole chapter. Give me
yeah,
a sense of it.
it says, Leah's servant, Zilpha,
verse what?
Verse 12, sorry.
Okay.
And it goes on. It just says, it shows how several women, including Leah and Rachel and some of their servants, you know, had sons or children with Jacob. And it says, it just seems to me, I'm getting the, you know, the kind of, I'm just getting a feeling that it sort of is endorsing polygamy in a
okay,
sense.
Okay, let me try to respond to that quickly for you, because it's not just in Genesis 30.
Yeah.
It's all the way through the Old Testament. You have polygamous circumstances that happen on a fairly regular basis, certainly in the case of the kings. Solomon had many wives, you know, like a... you know, 100 wives and, as one kid put it, 200 porcupines, meaning yeah. concubines. So you have that circumstance all the way through. Keep in mind, this is an important kind of principle here, that the Bible faithfully records what happens. It doesn't, simply because it records what happens, means it endorses everything that happens. There are a number of other places where you see pretty gruesome things happen that are recorded. And God doesn't, in a sense, weigh in with his point of view about this, not in those passages. So one might mistakenly believe that since God didn't weigh in on it, that this in the silence, he doesn't address it in the lives of these people, then the silence is is endorsement. Now, when I opened my first hour here today, I talked about the claim that Jesus was silent with regards to homosexuality, and there is a sense in which that is true. There's also a sense in which it wasn't, but just because, and even if, or even though he was silent, what can we conclude from that regarding his opinion about it? And my answer was, you can't conclude anything, not in that case, because there are all kinds of things that Jesus was silent about that I think we're fairly confident he didn't endorse, like wife beating or child molesting or something like that. So in the case of Genesis, we see a lot of things that are happening. There's a case here where Abraham kind of gives his wife to a king, or allows the king to take his wife. And is it Abraham? Yeah, I think it's Abraham. It says that it's his sister. Because he feared the king,
yeah.
and so he didn't want to be killed for the sake of his wife, like kill the guy, take the woman. That used to happen, and so he just pretends like he's his sister. Well, is that condemned in the passage? It's not, but because it's condemned doesn't mean it's endorsed. So the first mistake is just thinking because it's recorded and God, it works with the set of circumstances, that doesn't mean that he's endorsing it. In fact, I don't think he endorses it, though I think that the issue of polygamy, I will tell you for myself, is a little bit troublesome because not only do you see it here, I'm not troubled by the Genesis 30 passage, but when you get into the life of David, when David takes Bathsheba, that God makes a statement there when he says, you know, didn't I didn't I give you all these wives? Didn't you have all these concubines? You know, and now you're taking what isn't yours when you had tremendous provision. I need to look at the passage more carefully before I can draw strong conclusions about this, but it kind of troubles me because at that point you think, wait a minute, give you all these wives. Because God himself tells the kings not to multiply wives to themselves. Part of the reason is when you get a new wife, you get her gods with them. And with her. And so this is what caused Solomon to fall into idolatry later on in his life. So apart from that little speed bump, which I don't know what to do with that statement with regards to David, there I see no indication that God endorses polygamy, even though he was willing, in a sense, to wink at it or to let it be for the time being. We do get a very straightforward statement, though, from Jesus in Matthew chapter 19. And here's what Jesus says in Matthew 19. The question was about a divorce, all right? And the Pharisee said, is it possible or is it legal to divorce a woman for any cause whatsoever? And Jesus answers this way, and he answers with a principle that has broad application. So he's arguing deductively. He's saying, here's the broad principle, and your question is an example of a specific application. But the broad principle has broader application. And here's what Jesus says in verse 4. Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. How many, by the way?
One.
One flesh they become from how many?
The two.
The two, right. Yeah. The male and the female. Consequently, they are no longer two but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. Now, the principle here applies obviously to the question that is being asked to him, but it has broader application. Notice in the creation order, you have male and female. I should say you have humans with humans, not humans with animals, because animals were first for Adam, available, but they weren't suitable helpmates. So God makes him a suitable helpmate. So you have God's design is not humans with animals. It is not males with males and females with females, but male with female. And it is one male with one female, and it is for life. All of those conclusions are implicit in these statements. So whatever was going on in the Old Testament, and for whatever reason God was willing to, in a sense, wink at it or not deal with it under those circumstances, but work with it, we are not to take that as an endorsement, because by Jesus' own statement, from the beginning, which takes us back before Genesis 30, God already had a prior plan, and that prior plan was the creation order, one man with one woman for life.
Now, actually, let me comment for a second, but about the Abraham, I'm not sure. I seem to remember that when he had offered Sarah as his sister? Is that what you were referring to?
Yeah.
Yeah, and
right,
I'm
right,
not sure. I seem to remember that God had said something like, you didn't trust me, or that I would have, you know, given you a son or whatever. But
that's a different passage. Else? There is a lack of trust. I mean, God promises Abraham an heir, one who comes forth from his own loins. He realizes that his wife Sarai is not is barren, and she's old, just like he is. But apparently he's still capable of having a child, and so instead of going in to Sarai, who he doesn't think is going to bear him the son of promise, he goes into her handmaid, who he has a child with by proxy. In other words, the handmaid stands in for his wife, and he thinks that's how God is going to give him an heir. And this is where God says, no, this isn't what I have in mind. He meets with him at the Oaks of Mamre there in Genesis 18, and he says, I'm going to give you a son with Sarah. And Sarah starts laughing. Really? What a joke, you know, that's where that conversation comes in. So the approbation comes at that point for not trusting God to fulfill the promise of a seed through his wife, the way God apparently originally communicated it. The issue with Abimelech or whoever it is that Sarah went with for a while, this actually is a different incident altogether. The point I was making with that illustration is just simply because it happened and there was no correction by God doesn't mean that God thought it was fine that Abraham lies about his wife implicitly and lets his wife go off with another man.
Yeah, and I agree with that, and I find that in most of the texts that I look at, and I always try to give it the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
But when I came across this, it seemed to be like I'll read from verse 17 here in Genesis 30, where it said, God listened to Leah, and she became pregnant and bore Jacob a fifth son.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at this time, I think Jacob was already married to Rachel,
mm-hmm.
so it seemed like God listened to Leah, it says, about her wanting to have a child with Jacob,
well,
which that's where I get to. It seems like it's almost endorsing.
Well, wait a minute. He was already married to Leah first, and then he marries Rachel afterwards. So the fact is the marriage is already consummated with both. And in the case of this marriage where he has two wives now, one is crying out for a child, and God answers that prayer. So this is post the marriage. So this the fact that God answers the prayer of Leah to get to have a child doesn't tell us anything about God's ideas about polygamy to begin with. Polygamy was already a fact in this case. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, I'm just under the impression from reading chapter 29 or just briefing through it that he was already married to Rachel, and then he had a child with Leah. So even if he was,
this is the two sisters, right? And
yeah.
So he works for all those years, and he gets tricked, and the first wife is Leah, the elder.
Yeah, he had relations with her first, but then I believe he married Rachel after that. It says that.
No, that's true. No, you're right. He does. But here's the point I'm making. Leah is the first wife. So it shouldn't be unusual for God to grant Leah's request to have a child. She was the first wife. It's Rachel that was the second wife. But in either case, God can still grant their request because they're both of his wives. God is not endorsing polygamy. Simply because, given the fact of those polygamous relationships, he grants children to those women.
Okay. I might just not understand the background. I mean, I hope that's what it is, because, you know, the more you dig into these things, the more answers
you
get.
Well,
I'm not that well versed with the Old Testament.
Right. I don't know that the problem here is understanding the background so much as I mean, that's not the point I'm making. It isn't like if you really understood the society. The society was polygamous. That's pretty straightforward. I think there's an error in thinking that because God gave children to these women of a polygamous marriage that somehow God was endorsing polygamy when all he was doing was answering the prayer of the woman who prayed for a child by her husband, who her husband was – it was a husband that was legally her husband under the laws of that time. So,
well, wouldn't that be an illegitimate husband, though? I mean, kind of if only, you can only have one husband.
Yeah,
that is
different from God's original plan, according to what Jesus says here in Matthew 18, and of course what anyone can read for themselves in the first couple of chapters of Genesis. But even if that marriage isn't what God wanted, in other words, that style of culture where you have polygamy isn't part of God's original plan, it doesn't mean that everything stops after that, that God doesn't work and do anything. These are people who are in polygamy, all right? So now, even though they're in polygamy, God can still give children to the wives who ask for children. I don't see the connection between God granting the answer to prayer for a child and God's endorsement of the polygamy. I don't see that at all. You could have a daughter who gets married to somebody you don't want her to marry and still bring a gift to the wedding.
Yeah.
Or still treat the grandchildren with kindness. Doesn't mean you're endorsing this original marriage, but the fact of the marriage is staring you in the face, and you figure, okay, now what do I do? You know, you don't disown them. There's a nice, sweet kid looking at you. You're the grandpa, so you respond. I mean, something along those lines. But the ultimate response is Jesus' own comments in Matthew chapter 19. And that's where chapter 19, the first couple of verses. There you get Jesus' point of view based on creation order. And that would be my final salvo. Okay, thanks for the call, Mike from Chicago. Going to break, and when we come back, Brett Kunkel from Stand to Reason and Sean McDowell, and we're going to learn about a little adventure they had up in Berkeley a month or so ago. Stay with us. Hi, this is Greg Kokel, letting you know that Stand to Reason is back with an unmatched cruise conference experience featuring some of the top Christian thinkers in the country. On August 2, 2008, we'll set sail from Vancouver, BC for 8 days aboard one of Holland America's finest cruise ships. We're planning a voyage you'll never forget. It's specifically designed for those who want to represent Christ to a world looking for answers to life's toughest questions. Here's our plan. We want to challenge you with thoughtful presentations, answer your questions in open forum discussions, and enrich you through interaction and fellowship with expert speakers and fellow passengers. Add to that the stunning splendor of the Alaskan coastline and a 7-day itinerary that includes Glacier Bay, Skagway, Juneau, and Ketchikan. I'll be joined by some of our distinguished guest speakers, Josh McDowell, J.P. Moreland, and Sean McDowell. Come and join Stand to Reason and our lineup of speakers for a memorable spiritual adventure. You'll enjoy plenty of fun and relaxation, along with ample opportunity to meet our speakers, ask questions, and enjoy each other's company. Listen, if studying Christian subjects with some of the sharpest minds on the planet, in the fellowship of other believers of kindred spirit, aboard a beautiful ship sailing the Alaskan coastline, sounds like your idea of a perfect vacation, then this is the trip for you. As always, you don't need any prior understanding of the subject matter. Simply bring a desire to learn in a relaxing environment. We planned everything about this trip with your enjoyment and your enrichment in mind. But don't just take my word for it. Visit str.org and see what other guests of Stand to Reason have said about past STR cruises. Save the dates, download the brochure from str.org, and then contact Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. They're helping us with our trip, and their skilled staff are committed to answering all your questions. I look forward to seeing you on board.
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last, just kicking down the cobblestones.
Coming back at you here at Stand to Reason, Greg Kokel, and we just got a little surprise here. Two of my favorite people are sharing the show with me. Brett Kunkel, welcome to the show, Brett.
Good to be with you, Greg.
And Sean McDowell. Sean.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. These guys, and of course, you listeners know both because both have been on the show before. Brett's sat in for me many times when I've been off doing other things in other parts of the country, and Sean, of course, we just had you on about a month or so ago, huh, Sean? Talking about the cruise coming up and the things that you're doing. Let me have Brett, why don't you just kind of lead off here, because you've been doing these adventures now for a couple of years, I'm not sure how well the audience is familiar with these kind of adventures you take kids on, youth. And why don't you just go ahead and introduce the whole issue to us?
Well, this is the third year that we've done a mission trip to Berkeley, but mission is it's a little different than your average mission trip where you're going and serving the poor or something like that. And these actually sprang out of the mission trips we were doing to Utah. Mm-hmm. And I'd done several with a good friend of ours, Jim Wallace, down here at the Rising Tide. And he was the one who had the spark for this idea 3 years ago. He said, these Utah trips have been so great in training our students in theology and in scripture, and there's nothing like this. Mm-hmm. And he said, can we come up with something like this that would train them in philosophy and apologetics as well? Mm-hmm. And then Jim kind of offhandedly said, why don't we go to Berkeley? Mm-hmm. And he kind of charged me with that. And so we built a trip from scratch 3 years ago, went up to Berkeley.
Before you go to the Berkeley thing, just tell us a little bit about the Utah trip, because you and I are familiar with how this works, but a lot of people aren't. And it's the nature of the what you do. It isn't like a bunch of kids go up and gawk at the temple. Pardon me. You have training sessions. Hey, bring us up to date on what happens when you go to the temple and Salt Lake City, and then we'll go to the Berkeley thing.
Well, we do training before a trip like this, and we'll do. And Sean and I did training before the Berkeley trip. Before every one of these trips, there's a good amount of training where we are equipping these students in theology or apologetics. And with Utah, we're teaching them about Mormonism, and then teaching them about Orthodoxy. And then when we go up, we put them in situations where they have opportunities to engage someone who's a Mormon. And so whether it's talking to people, doing surveys on the streets of Salt Lake City in Temple Square, or engaging missionaries who are leading the tours, or talking to students at BYU, we put them in situations where they're able to have significant conversations about these things. And, of course, in Utah, theology is kind of on everyone's mind, and so it's easy to get into conversation.
Yeah, that's, it reminds me of Jesus sending out the 70. So he spent some time teaching them and said, okay, out you go. Get face-to-face with the people you need to talk to, and that's what happens in Utah, for example. How do the kids respond generally? I mean, I can imagine, especially for high school-age kids or college-age kids, you know, this is still going to be a little unnerving. You can do the stuff back at the church, but when you get out in the field and they're face-to-face with the other side, which that's got to be pretty frightening for them.
Yeah, every one of these trips, and I think Sean would probably agree with me on this, even with this Berkeley trip and his seniors from Capistrano Valley, there's always some fear, some anxiety. Students are really nervous, and it's kind of unknown for them. But they also know this is going to be a really big challenge, and sometimes the opposition, it just seems a little bit bigger and stronger and more fierce than
it actually is.
So they go with a lot of fear and trembling at the outset, and it's just amazing to watch the transformation that happens in just a few short days with some of these trips, where they start off timid and fearful, and by the end of the trip, they are bold and courageous and just filled with confidence.
So what about the late night interactions after things are over with? I know I've talked to you about some of these trips up to Utah, and these are like kids like really couldn't give a rip about theology, right?
Oftentimes they're hard to motivate to care about theology, and so this provides the motivation. After each event during the day, and then at night, we do debrief sessions. And Sean can vouch for this, that those were lively conversations where kids come back with, great stories, stories of how God has, opened up a door to talk to this particular person, and then stories of how they actually were articulating, their Christian view, and then coming back with their questions that were raised that they couldn't answer, and how do you work through that? And so it's just a tremendous time of training.
It's great to see then the kids who, like I said before, wouldn't have given a rip about theology. Here they are up to 2 and 3 in the morning with their nose buried in the books, knocking these ideas around because they've been knocked around maybe a little bit on the street, and now they're motivated kids.
That's right.
So you've done this you've done a number of these to Salt Lake City, and now you've done a few of these with Berkeley, and generally you're working with a group that's already well established, and this is where Sean comes in. Sean, you've been teaching down at Capistrano Valley School. In fact, I just drove by there about an hour and a half ago, coming up from San Diego this morning. Tell us about your kids, what you've been doing with them for the last couple of years, and how this this field trip, so to speak, fits into your overall plan for your own students.
Well, this is my fifth year teaching, and I teach Old Testament to freshmen, and then we do some theology, we do cults, world religions, and then the senior year is where we really focus on apologetics. We get into intelligent design, we look at multiple worldviews, the historical Jesus, ethical issues, and like Brett just said a minute ago, is probably half of my energy in the classroom is trying to persuade young people that these issues really matter. I mean, I think when kids see that apologetics matters, they come alive, but there's a lot of energy spent trying to convince them. So I get a lot of letters back after kids graduate going, oh, yeah, now I see this is important. I wish I could be back in your class and take this again.
Right.
And I just was scratching my head going, boy, I wish there was a way to get them to grasp this ahead of time so their experience in my class would be different. And when Brett and when Brett was talking about this trip, it just clicked to me. I said, hey, let's partner and let's bring my students up there. And, the interesting thing is I have 61 seniors this year. And we really tipped it off at the beginning of the year. I brought Brett in and we kind of set him up. We really did set him up. And I told him that Brett, Dr. Kunkel has a PhD from Berkeley. He's an atheist. None of them saw it coming. And keep in mind, these are seniors in high school who've been in Bible class, who have been in the church their whole life.
They've been in your Bible class, by the way. It's not just any Bible class. They've been in your Bible class. So they know a lot more than the rank and file, I'm sure.
They do. Now, in one sense, it was the beginning of the apologetics year, so they hadn't officially had apologetics, mm-hmm. but they still had had theology. They still had had a decent amount of training. And the first week of school, Brett came in, and there were three different classes. And basically, within, you know, an hour, dismantled these students. And one of my top students who got the top Bible award, he said to me, he goes, "Man, we got owned." And Brett just brought, I mean, he did a great, gracious
yeah,
job.
Yeah, he's a real good heathen.
Yeah. I got a lot of practice.
I'm not even sure if he was acting, but, no. And what we did, though, is afterwards we said, look, you know, we set you up, we admit, but we actually want to go up to Berkeley and expose you to real atheists mm-hmm. and real, you know, people who are homosexual activists of different ideas. And we actually didn't, you know, a lot of youth group events, it's like we're just begging kids to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually made it tough for them. You know, we had a three-page application that Brett put together they had to do. They all had to interview with me. They had to get a certain grade in my class. They had to do additional training. And we had, 22 or 23 seniors go mm-hmm. through the whole process. Mm-hmm. And go with us up to Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And they loved it. I mean, Brett just did an amazing job, and it really, there was some transformation in the yeah. lives of these kids.
Brett, do you notice when, I know you've done this I'm the atheist shtick before, and it really shakes the students up at first. Do you notice that when, here they are in this kind of safe environment of their Sunday school class or whatever it happens to be, and then you walk in there as Mr. Atheist. What is the first kind of emotional reaction that you sense from these students?
Well, when you walk in and they think you're a real atheist, there is the air is thick, the tension is thick in the air, and you can feel the tension when you walk in. And a lot of times, the first reaction there's a hesitancy. But then I think there's a little bit of a defensiveness, and they're threatened. Mm-hmm. They're threatened. This guy is in here to dismantle, you know, my faith. And so there's kind of a defensiveness. And it now depends on the particular groups. Some groups where students have been trained, like Sean's group that has more training, they're willing to engage in the arguments. Mm-hmm. And there are other groups that. 5-10 minutes into it, they've got nothing left to say,
mm-hmm.
and so then they start emoting, or you know they, right. you know they, or they'll get upset, or you know, or they'll convert to atheism.
Oh, great. Well, do you find that there's kind of this sense of fear that they're going to hear something here they're not going to be able to deal with, and it might shake their faith. That there's a sense of safety they feel kind of in their own group, that nobody's going to say anything that's going to challenge them too hard, so they don't have to defend anything too hard?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I ask students, you know, if they've got a friend who's an atheist, a lot of them will say, yeah, they raise their hand, they've got friends who are atheists. But then when you ask them the follow-up question, how many significant conversations have you had mm-hmm. about that? You know, the number drops radically, and they're not used to having conversations with people who don't share their view.
So after you've kind of trashed them in a good way here on the idea level that they're not able to deal with, and then you tell them, well, I'm not really an atheist, I'm really a Christian. Does that change the mood a little bit? What happens then?
Yeah, usually there's a huge sigh of relief. And they breathe a sigh of relief. They, you know, basically they say, thank God,
uh-huh.
because, you know, they realize they did a very poor job in defending the faith. And they're exposed. Mm-hmm. They end up being exposed in mm-hmm. that situation.
I guess I would think if I were them, like, oh, gosh, I'm glad he's on our side. And he must know something that can answer all the challenges that he's given to us that we haven't been able to challenge. And the motivation level goes up then.
Yeah, absolutely. And I tell you what, after I tell them who I am and we get through that initial reaction of relief, then I have their ear.
Uh-huh.
Then they're willing to sit there they're ready to sit there and yeah. listen to me say to them, you need to know what you believe and why you believe it mm-hmm. and how to articulate it.
Mm-hmm.
And if I would come in, you know, and it's just Brett Kunkel from Standard Reason here to teach us, well, the motivational level is not there
right.
like it
oh,
is.
Oh, another speaker. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know what the real
Sean.
Value, I think ultimately the real value of doing a trip like this is we're not going to answer, even on the Berkeley campus or in Utah, answer all of kids' objections.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is they get challenged. I mean, we had a speaker the first time who just threw out probably 200 objections and just listed them off and kind of was blowing away the students. And then we went back and one by one dissected them, and their confidence grew. They said, okay, I didn't have an answer for that one. Now I see how to get it. So when these kids go off to college, they go off, you know, the graduate school, the real life, and they hear some objection they've never heard, they might not know how to answer it, but they have the confidence and the experience that says, you know what, there is an answer out there. And to me, if I leave a student just with that thought, I mean, I feel like I've succeeded in many ways as a teacher.
Sean McDowell, tell us a little bit about the layout of the program. So you took your group up there with Brett, and you had some events that were scheduled. You hinted at it just a moment ago about a speaker who threw out 200 different objections. But what does it look like? I mean, this to bring your students up there, what do they do? What do they engage? What do they face?
Let me give you a little heads up, kind of some of the training we did leading into it, and then I'll tell you specifically what we did. Outside of my class, which is a Bible class that kids have through the year, we did four trainings outside at night. So we actually took the kids to see Michael Shermer debate Dinesh D'Souza.
Michael Shermer, the editor of Skeptic Magazine, the atheist. When you say we, do you mean, were you involved in that, Brett?
Yes.
Oh, so the two of you are kind of a tag team as trainers.
Yeah, we were partnering with each other with ideas, training students on hand, working together. So afterwards, we just went and sat down. And their interest has peaked there, too, because they just went. We went actually up to Pasadena, which is where, you know, the Skeptic Society is based. And there was probably more non-Christians than Christians there. So when the debate was done for an hour, we just debriefed it. We talked about it. We actually had a friend of mine who lives in my neighborhood who's an agnostic. And he came to my house, and for 2 hours there was just a conversation where he shared his concerns, reason why he's not a Christian, challenged my students, and we had a conversation. And Brett and I got to kind of chime in and guide it a little bit, and was just preparatory. We also had Craig Hazen come in, and then my dad do some training ahead of time, just outside of class. And Craig Hazen does this kind of plays the role of a professor again and walks them through how to respond and talk and so they had a good amount of training, like Brett said, going into it.
So it's kind of a controlled exposure to these people where they're really getting exposed to the issues, and not just to the issues but the people themselves, but in a very, very controlled way.
That's right. I mean, I think, and you know, Brett and I have talked about this, a trip like this, if you didn't adequately prepare students and have the right type of leadership with you, you could do a lot of damage.
Yeah.
I think you could really, you know, hurt a kid's faith.
Brett.
So we, you know, and Brett just does a great job of being conscientious about that and, you know, and preparing and playing kind of a fatherly role with the students.
And
so on my trip, we have. Oh, go ahead.
Let me jump in here. So I was going to say one of the things about your training also was that they had 5 months of apologetic class with you,
which is more than you usually get on a trip like this.
Right, right. So that was huge. That was key. And I think we want to make sure that people understand that you don't want to do, you know, four simple training sessions and then take them up.
Don't do this at home.
Yeah, the four the sessions that Sean did were supplements to the training he's already doing with them every day in class.
Okay, Sean, so when you get to Berkeley, what happens?
Well, here's what we did. We actually only had 2 full days up there, so we jumped in Suburbans, kind of had a road trip, 7-8 hour drive, went up there, stayed in a church, and Brett arranged a lot of these particulars, relationships he had built from previous trips, and then what we did is we brought in 3 speakers on the campus of the church, and they would speak for about 30 minutes roughly, and then an hour of interaction with the students. And kind of during this time, we wanted to let the students do most engaging, but Brett and I kind of sat back, and at times when, you know, kids didn't have an answer or got a little out of control, we'd kind of moderate the discussion a little bit. And then we'd go debrief it sometimes for another 45 minutes or an hour after that.
So just for clarification's sake, it wasn't the kids sitting in as an audience listening to the speakers and then you and Brett kind of dealing with the speakers. They were on their own, having been trained in advance to kind of – you were a safety net there, but they were the ones that were really meant to engage, as I understand it, right?
They were designed to, yeah. And there, I mean, there was a couple times where Brett and I would jump in to just try to show the students, you know, an experience, a level that they don't have, to kind of demonstrate technically and content-wise how to be a good ambassador. So that was maybe, I don't know, maybe 10% of it, but they certainly did the majority majority of the discussion.
What would you say happened with your students as a result of this trip? I mean, think of your kids, even with the training, which is excellent training that you give down there at the school, even with that training, what was the difference between kind of getting the training and then having training and going to Berkeley for a couple of days and engaging these really sharp people on the issues? What was the difference in the lives of your students?
I can tell you a few differences. Number one is in my class for the rest of the year, the kids who went start to participate a little bit more. They ask better questions. They see that it matters.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one area. We've had a number of students say, boy, I've had a couple students from the trip say, I want to study philosophy. I want to go into apologetics. I want to go to Biola.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're talking big life decisions mm-hmm. shaped by this. And also, I've thrown out there a couple other opportunities. We have a conference coming up with Lee Strobel, and we have another debate in May, and I just said, hey, how many of you want to go? And all the Berkeley students wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they just want more of it. So yeah. It's just created a fire, and they feel like, oh, we wish we did this as sophomores so we could do it every year. So I think it's just kind of like when life, some people get it, and some people don't. This is a trip where their eyes were just opened up and created a hunger for knowledge, a confidence. In fact, at one point when we do these surveys that Brett put together, there was about our trip was so packed full. There was about a 1 hour break where we could just walk around. And I went to lay under a tree and I napped. I was so wiped. And I get up and I walk around. And some of my students are going to engage in more conversations.
Right on their own,
just loving it so much.
Brett, did you find out or do you discover in these trips that the students are somewhat, after they get over the kind of the shock of engagement, they're somewhat surprised to find out how poor the other side does when given the opportunity?
Yeah, I think they realize that these arguments are not as scary, and the opposition is not quite as scary as they originally thought.
Mm-hmm.
And they I think realize that the truth is actually on our side.
Mm-hmm.
And so and that's part of this trip is we want to expose them because we're not afraid. We think that we have the truth, and so all the arguments against the truth are going to be flawed by their very nature,
right.
and we have the confidence to go out and engage.
Well, we just got a minute or so to go. Brett, do you this is something you've been doing on an ongoing basis. People probably listening are thinking, gee, I've got a group. Maybe I'd like to, you know, send out and do something. Tell us, are you planning more of these in the future, and how would somebody go about kind of contacting you and playing with the idea of maybe putting something together at their church?
Yeah, well, what's interesting is we've already got two trips with two brand new groups lined up for next year already.
Mm-hmm.
And as word kind of gets out on this, people get pretty excited. And Sean's been talking about some of the feedback he's been getting on this trip. But they can contact Amy, who handles all my scheduling at Stand to Reason, mm-hmm. amy@str.org, or call the office, and they can begin the conversation with her. But, yeah, we'd love to take more groups up. This, in terms of the events I do, this is kind of the pinnacle event. I mean, mm-hmm. I go and speak at a chapel for 30 minutes and have limited impact. But when I get to be with a group for 4 or 5 days in mm-hmm. Berkeley, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. And Sean, I think, will agree the last night in Berkeley with his students was just electric.
Mm-hmm.
We had a last event with the atheist group on Berkeley's campus where afterwards our students broke up and engaged the atheists on their own and were in – I mean, they were in like 10 different conversations going on. And after we walked out of that room after about another hour and a half of conversation, they were just abuzz.
Mm.
And you couldn't get them to shut up. I mean, they were so excited. And I had some of the students come up to me and say, oh, my gosh, I actually explained an argument for God's existence. And they were so excited about that. And it was really transformational.
Sean, I know you do more than teach in high school. So just in the 30 seconds here, tell us if you do a lot of speaking around the country, especially to youth, but you're expanding. You're going to be on the cruise with us August 2nd through 9th. You'll be talking about how adults, I think what you're going to be addressing is how parents can help their kids in the ways that you're helping the kids at Capistrano Valley. So tell us a little bit about how people can get in touch with you if they wanted to get more information about your work.
My ministry, just sean@seanmcdowell.org. Email in there, and seanmcdowell.org is my website,
mm-hmm.
so they can get a hold of me through that. But let me say real fast, if someone's interested in this trip, the first thing to do is bring Brett in as a speaker into a weekend retreat,
mm-hmm.
bring him in to talk to your parents, to a special night, bring him into a classroom, and start the process there and see the reaction it has with the students. So instead of just jumping into a trip, call in and just say, hey, is Brett available for a chapel? Is he available to come talk to my students, come talk to my class? And I think when you build that relationship, you'll get the ball rolling. So in a matter of time, you can do a trip like this. So that'd be the first trip. And as a teacher, we bring in speakers all the time, and Brett has just done a great job. We bring him in every year.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope everybody listening would at least take that first step to get the ball rolling there.
Well, Sean, thanks so much. It's good to have you on the air, and I look forward to August 2nd through 9th, where we'll be having Alaska vacation together, training people to think more carefully about their faith and enjoying that beautiful coastline along Alaska. So I'm looking forward to that with you and your dad.
Me too. That'll be great. Thanks, Greg.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks. And Brett, I will see you, in a week or so, aren't we? Saturday the 19th of this month, Faith Defense Weekend Conference in Highlands Ranch, Colorado. We'll be
working that
together, won't we?
Yes, we will.
Yeah, so if you guys are within striking distance of that, you can go to our website, and we have more information about that. Faith Defense Weekend Conference, Highlands Ranch, Colorado. Go to str.org. Or I guess we got a contact here, chcc.org. More information about that. Look forward to seeing you then, Brett.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Should we just, we're a little tight on time. Why don't we just go back to the phones and skip this last break? Is that okay? Will that work with you guys? Because I know people have waited for a long time. Let's go and talk with Tim. Tim, welcome to Stand to Reason in Toronto.
Thank you, Greg.
You're welcome.
I'm one of those people that probably listen to every CD that STR makes, and they're all fantastic.
That's great. Thanks, Tim.
Especially the decision-making I listen to maybe hundreds of times.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm into conversations with my Christian friends about it after they've listened to it, they always get back to, you know, how they're having these desires, and they're trying to attribute it to God speaking to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I've explained it, I want you to see, correct me if I go astray here, but if a person is following Christ, and the Holy Spirit's within us, and we are going through the process of sanctification. Mm-hmm. I mean, God's desires, and we're not explained how that happens, but God's desires somehow become our desires.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I used to not love people, now I love people.
Mm-hmm.
I used to not want people to be saved, now I want people to be saved, and sometimes it's specific people.
Right.
Now, they want it, and I don't think it's any more complicated than that, but that's part of our sanctification process, and I'm not willing to call that God speaking to me. That's something else.
Mm-hmm.
Yet they might want to take those kinds of urges and make them. It's just a matter of language,
right? Well, it certainly is a matter of language, in that a lot of the confusion is a result of the way people talk about this, particularly when they're using language in non-biblical ways. So when they use the phrase led by the Spirit, they're using the phrase in a way that's different than, say, Paul does in Romans 8 or in Galatians 5, which is the only two places in any of the epistles where this actually in the whole New Testament where this phrase is used. And so they get confused because they were putting kind of 20th century, 21st century now definitions, Christian definitions on words that were written 2,000 years ago and really intended by Paul to mean something different than what people mean now. So there is there's this word problem. But let me try to explain what I think is going on in the question that you're raising here. You notice in our material, of course, we talk about the way the Bible uses the phrase "the will of God." It uses the phrase to describe God's sovereign will and God's moral will. There doesn't seem to be any characterization in the New Testament that has to do with this third category. Well, then there's the individual will, and God says God's got a will for every person, that they've got to discover this blueprint in order to be able to know what to do in their day-to-day lives and the important questions that they have to answer, like what school do I go to, or job, or who do I marry, or ministry, or those kinds of things. That concept of God's will seems to be absent from the Scriptures. So when it comes to decision-making, a lot of people are thinking of this third category of God's will, not just God's sovereign will, things that he sovereignly designs to happen, and that's secret, or his moral will, the things he wants every Christian to do, all the righteous living and everything we read about in the Scriptures, but also this third category. They're looking for that. And so then as they're trying to make decisions in their life, they are trying to figure out if the circumstances lining up a certain way or the feelings they have are ways. They're trying to figure out if God is doing that as a way of hinting to them what they, what God wants them to do. So, well, somebody was talking to me about mission work, and then I went to this magazine, and I saw this thing about the mission work in this country, and I started feeling the desire. Was this God doing these things, and is God the author of this feeling in my heart? Is he kind of guiding me? It seems to be all working together. And so that what they're trying to do is essentially piece together the parts of the puzzle.
I'd like to pick it up right there and then put my next point. I agree with that. And it comes to the motivation. I find there's two categories. There are some well-meaning Christians, and I think some of them are wanting to be super spiritual when they use the God told me language. But I think there's another category, and this is more common, I think, where they have a real problem with this, the freedom. Like, I mean, it's a freedom in Christ, and we can see it in the history of humanity. There's a tendency to legalism. And I think it's right in the church. We want the rules so we don't have to make decisions, and that's the real motivation in it.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think but at the same time, I actually think most people are just, in a sense, genuinely confused about this because of the way preachers talk and other Christians have talked, and they say these things because they actually think this is the right godly biblical thing to do. But just to finish the thought I was making before, they have this third category of God's will, and they think that God has taken this specific will and for their lives, and he's kind of made a code out of it, and we have to decipher the code to know what we're supposed to do. And essentially what it amounts to when people are saying, gee, is this God putting this idea in my mind or what, is what they're trying to do is they're trying to look behind the curtain of God's sovereignty. And God's sovereign will is private. It's private to God. And it's kind of like, who was it? R.C. Sproul, I think, said, that's none of your business. So in practical terms, when people get desires about something, I do not think that it is a relevant question to ask. Is this God putting the desire in my heart, or is it my own desire? Now, the reason they ask the question is they think, if I can figure out if God's putting it in my heart, then I know to do it. And I don't have to go through the process of decision-making. The decision is made for me. But if it's my own desire, well, that's suspect because, you know, I'm flesh and I get it wrong, and so God knows best. My response is simply, don't ask that question because it's not a legitimate question. Whether you don't have to figure out which desires God puts in your heart and which he doesn't. You have to figure it out. Sometimes it becomes obvious that there is a godly desire that you're moving on, that God has placed there, and he's going to bring it to fulfillment. I think God placed the desire in my heart to start Stand to Reason. But 15 years ago when we started it, I wasn't saying, is this God's desire, is my desire? All I had to do was ask, is this a good desire? Is this a rich, sound decision?
Is this a good and wise thing to do? And then
exactly.
Do I want to do it?
Yeah, and do I have the skills to do it? Are the circumstances such that it is a prudent use of my time, a wise use of my time and capabilities? And this is why, and we're approaching the 15-year anniversary of this now, May 1st, 1993, I think that was the date, Melinda and I got together, Melinda Penner and I got together with about 50 or 60 people from Hope Chapel to get their opinion. These are people that we trusted and that were close to us, to get their opinion about Stand to Reason. And prior to that, we had a meeting about a month and a half earlier than that with about 9 people, a much more of spiritual leaders that were much more close inner group. My brother was part of that, as a matter of fact. And we wanted to lay this plan out and see what they thought about it. Now, what we weren't trying to do is decipher their responses to see if God was telling us what to do. That's the step that is not required biblically and just creates a lot of confusion. Where's God's voice in all of this? Rather, we said, we have a plan. We want your counsel. What is your counsel? We took their counsel and we responded to their counsel. They raised a number of issues. We dealt with those issues and then brought it back to a larger group and asked for their counsel and for their money. And that's what kicked off Stand to Reason proper. And here we are 15 years later as God has prospered the enterprise. The Holy Spirit was working through the whole thing, but we were never in a position where we had to, you know, try to decipher the clues and, you know, that kind of thing.
I think when they do it, it's a form of bondage. When like when people live that way, it's just and it's a fear of freedom. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's fear of freedom. You mentioned that a couple of times, and it may be. I mean, that's a legitimate, you know, speculation. I don't particularly share that. I do think it is a form of bondage, though, and I know this because so many people have told me, and maybe this is part of your own story too, Tim, that they were really in bondage by this other method, trying to hear the voice of God, trying to put together the pieces of the puzzle, trying to decipher the code to figure out what God wanted them to do. And one of two things happened. Either it was very, very confusing for them because they couldn't figure out what was God's message and what wasn't, or the heavens were brass and they weren't getting anything and they thought they were sub-spiritual. Yeah. Because God wasn't talking to them. And when we came along with our material, decision-making in the will of God, and all subsequent teaching called From Truth to Experience, where I go into more detail about some of these things, are two different teaching training tools that we have at Stand to Reason. And people listen to these things. They do come back to us and say, man, I was in bondage to this before, and now that I understand the biblical model, boy, I feel a tremendous sense of freedom.
So I'm not off base explaining it as the Holy Spirit informing our desires is something that's not really God speaking to you. It's just the natural process of sanctification.
Yeah, I think that's part of the package about how the Holy Spirit works. In other words, our desires become more sanctified, and we have better, richer, more noble desires to then act on in a good way that God can bless. I put it this way sometimes when it comes to decisions, the decisions people are making, and I say it this way, it's an overstatement, I'm saying in advance, but it's meant to be a little iconoclastic and shake people up. I say, okay, when it comes to these things, keep God out of it. Now, what I mean by that is don't let a bunch of God talk confuse you. The God talk I'm talking about is God talk that relates to, is God leading me? Is God putting that desire in my heart? What does God want for me in this circumstance? That kind of thing. What is God's specific will for my life in this circumstance? Now, I don't want God talk like that to confuse people. I do want biblical God talk. That is, biblical references where we know God has spoken, given us principles and commands and directives for our life. I want those things to be part of the process. So when I started Stand to Reason, since it was an organization that had to do with speaking and teaching and training and writing, I had asked myself, do I have gifts for those purposes? Because the Scripture teaches that God distributes ministry through gifting. And there were other questions that were biblical questions that I had to ask. And that's the kind of way that God comes into the picture, not through this confusing, is God telling me, is this God's perfect will for my life? No, that's not a biblical analysis. Now, if this has piqued your curiosity, the two training tapes are Decision Making in the Will of God, available at str.org, and From Truth to Experience, also at str.org. Tim, thanks for the call, and I hope you guys get a hold of those tapes. They could change your life as well. That would be CDs now, because we're in the 21st century. All right, be back with you next week. In the meantime, be a good ambassador for Christ. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Go out and give them heaven, friends, okay? Bye-bye now.